Hello and welcome to another edition of Film Weekly. I'm Jason Solomons, and this week we look at the United States of American film. It's all here, from Transformers to The Simpsons Movie, to an experimental memoir to the thoroughly indie Sherry Baby, and a documentary about Nazi hunter Simon Wiesenthal. It's Film Weekly, and I'm Jason Solomons. Finally hitting British screens this week is a knockout performance from Maggie Gyllenhaal in Sherry Baby, a turn for which she was nominated at the Golden Globes and for which many felt she was harshly overlooked at the Oscars. As Sherry, Gyllenhaal plays a young New Jersey girl released early from prison and returning to see her young daughter for the first time in over 3 years. Having cleaned herself off heroin in jail, Sherry now faces a battle to get a job, stay off the drugs, and rediscover her daughter. Unusually for a film, I was crying after 15 minutes. When I spoke to Sherry Baby's director, Laurie Collier, I asked her how she managed to create such an emotional scene so early on.
I did interview this old friend of mine who the story is loosely based on her life, and she told me, actually that scene is directly from one of her interviews, because she told me when she came home, she wasn't sure, you know, what anybody had told her daughter, and sure enough, they lied to her, and she didn't know if her daughter would remember her or anything. So in the interview, she described the whole scenario where she gets home and her daughter sees her and instantly goes, "Mommy," you know. And she said that she held her and cried like that, like you see in the movie, for 2 hours.
Well, I mean,
I was like, well,
it's interesting, isn't it, that that comes from a real thing. I presume that the lady you're talking about is the for Sue who comes up
the end.
The dedication
yeah.
at the end is Sue. I was going to ask you about that, but you've revealed all very early on. I mean, it's interesting that that technique, that kind of, you know, documentary technique, which is to kind of talk to people and get the real story before putting it into a fiction, has kind of worked for you, that kind of transposure of a truth technique to a fictive technique. But some people would say, well, you know, just get on and write it. Do you find that there's a particular truth that comes out if you do this research?
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, it's in the old days that was just considered research. It wasn't really considered like making a fiction film have documentary elements. That was just like being a good writer, you know. You go to the source, you do your homework. But there are all sorts of different styles of movies now and genres and stuff, and so research isn't as much. It's a little bit more of a novelty, I can tell, just from the interview questions, you know, and conversations I have with people in the business. But, yeah, no, there's a lot of fiction in there, too. You know, when she sings to her family, I don't know where that came from. That came from my mind.
She sings Eternal Flame.
Eternal Flame,
rather beautifully as well, I thought. It's a lovely performance, definitely, from Maggie. And I know that's helped the film a lot. But I don't want to detract from the film, because I do think it's an extremely sensitive portrayal of her. But presumably, with a film that's so anchored in a major performance like this, the two of you collaborated quite strongly, I would suggest, on the moods and the angles and everything. So can you tell us a little bit at first about how you got Maggie Gyllenhaal? Because there you were, first-time filmmaker. A great script, but not easy to get someone who was doing it so well in their career as Maggie G.
Well, luckily, you know, her career has been slowly ascending since I met her. And, you know, luckily I did catch her at a time before she had done an Oliver Stone movie and a... what's his name? Stranger Than Fiction guy movie.
Yes, the Mark Foster.
His name.
Mark Foster.
Will
Ferrell.
You know, I got her the script shortly after seeing Secretary, so she hadn't done that many movies yet, and she was, you know, she had a good agency and good representation and stuff, but, you know, I think she's a lot more famous now, and, you know, the more famous you get, the more scripts you get, the harder it is to make contact.
To get the good ones. I mean, I don't know if this is in your script, because I haven't read the script, but certainly in the film, she does a lot of very emotional bearing scenes, and she does a lot of physically bearing scenes. We see a lot of naked
right.
Maggie Gyllenhaal. Not erotic at all, I must stress to anyone listening who thinks, brilliant, I might go.
Right?
It's very disturbing. It's a very kind of raw and vulnerable nakedness that we see, but there isn't, nevertheless, a lot of nakedness. I noticed this week that Maggie Gyllenhaal's been made the face and the body of Agent Provocateur Lingerie.
Oh, cool.
Yes, I was wondering if this is because they felt that she needed it, having seen Sherry Baby, because she doesn't have much in the way of lingerie in that film.
That's a cool job. Good for her.
Yes. But it,
especially,
I mean,
after having a baby, wow.
Yes, I know. She makes it difficult for everyone, I think. But it is a wonderful kind of... a nakedness that's very tender. Did that come from a great trust with you and her, because you're a female director and she's was in so many kind of compromising positions?
Yeah, I mean, obviously there was a lot of trust on both of our parts, and maybe in the beginning somewhat against our will, but we're both smart enough to know that, you know, the movie is Sherry, and unless Sherry's performance is spectacular, the movie's not going to be good. So we, you know, sort of put all reservations aside, anxieties and whatever, and just dove in the pool, you know. I mean, it really felt like that from both of our angles.
Was it a very scripted shoot, or were you improvising a lot?
Oh, no, it's all screenplay. It's all screenplay. I mean, she's an actress, so she fills in all sorts of blanks with her mannerisms and her how she plays each emotion. But, you know, it's a scripted film. It's not like we get to set. And,
right.
But, you know, with the daughter, with Ryan Simpkins' character, Alexis, we did a lot of improvising in and out of scenes to loosen her up.
Well, you'd have to, because she keeps picking up newspapers and throwing things around.
I know. And some of those moments really fit what's going on in the scene, like when she put the newspaper on her head.
How old is she?
Sherry's. At the time, she was 6. I guess she must be 9 or 10 now.
Mm-hmm. And is she like Drew Barrymore? Is she zoned out on Quaaludes and marijuana? Or is she fine?
I think she's fine.
Good.
I think she's fine.
But let's find out a little bit about Maggie Gyllenhaal. I happened to meet her when she did Secretary, and I thought we were a great star performance.
Cool.
And she's a lovely girl as well.
Yeah, she's very, very sweet. She has a very good heart and a very strong mind and a very strong dedication to her craft.
Yeah, they're quite serious, those Gyllenhaal guys.
Yeah,
I met
very
Jake
serious.
As well.
So, you know, it caused a certain amount of conflict when we would interpret the character differently, but all conflict that was sort of necessary to get that level of performance and also to shape Sherry as a character, because Sherry's got a lot of anger and a lot of hostility. So sometimes us fighting about Sherry was like, or us fighting about the movie. I mean, sometimes we would fight about Alexis, Ryan, and it was just like, at that point I knew I wasn't even talking to Maggie anymore. I was talking to Sherry. She really descended into her character at one point and had a hard time coming out.
She was pretty good at it for a girl who, I think, we know Maggie Gyllenhaal and Jake Gyllenhaal. They're kind of Hollywood royalty in a way. They're kind of Hollywood kids and totally grown up in Hollywood. Someone very far apart from the kind of New Jersey heroin-addicted single mum that Sherry is.
Well, as a director, I think it's your job, your responsibility to cast against type, because otherwise you're going to make movies about characters and not... and stereotypes and not, you know, living, breathing people who are full of contradictions. I mean, one thing, I get a lot of material, you know, through my agents and stuff to consider, and a lot of times producers will want the most obvious choice in the lead role, and it's just like, well, they've done this before. Yeah, I mean, it's a known, you know, it's just, I thought it was really important that Sherry not be like Sherry, you know, or what your image of Sherry would be. You know,
I think it worked very well. One of the pleasing things about your film, Laurie, is that it reminded me of a kind of more golden age of American indie films. And people recently,
that's sweet.
That's not me trying to crawl up to you. That's just me. It was just like, we haven't seen a film that looked like this for a while. And it used to be there were so many of these films around, and now you get one year you get the station agent, then another year you get maybe another, and then suddenly yours comes along. And I found it very refreshing, I have to say.
That's cool, yeah. Well, they don't tend to make a lot of money, and our industry is dominated by, you know, capital right now. But I hope to make another one.
Laurie Collier there, the director of Sherry Baby, starring Maggie Gyllenhaal. On a far bigger and more bombastic note, the Transformers are here. Michael Bay is still playing with budgets that would make 200 Sherry Babies, despite the fiascos of Pearl Harbor and The Island. Transformers, Robots in Disguise, is genius if you're a 12-year-old boy. Otherwise, it's a very noisy display of screeching rubber, twisted metal, jets, concrete, explosions, and lots of clunking. If hardware's your thing, then this is porn. Choppers, computer screens, planes, guns, cars, and big 10-ton trucks. It's not exactly eco-friendly. Basically, Shia LaBeouf buys a new car and it turns out to be an alien robot. Who knew? Other robots arrive and they fight other evil computer-hacking robots in scenes that recalled, for me at least, the dinosaurs clashing in 1 million years BC. All the while, the US government, led by Defense Secretary John Voight, seek advice from a hot blonde systems analyst. Not my thing at all, I'm afraid. The movie, I mean. Hot blonde computer geeks is another matter. Actually, I cried twice at the movies this week. First in Sherry Baby, as I mentioned before, and then a lot in the documentary I Have Never Forgotten You, The Life and Legacy of Simon Wiesenthal. For obvious reasons, I've always been a sucker for Holocaust footage, and there's plenty of that and skeletal victims here in the archive clips that set the scene for the remarkable, indefatigable Nazi hunter. Wiesenthal started out as an architect before the Nazis rounded him and his family up. I spoke to the film's director, Richard Trank, and asked him first why he chose Nicole Kidman to narrate his film.
We like to go with choices that aren't obvious. For instance, our film The Long Way Home, which was about the survivors of the Holocaust rebuilding new lives for themselves after the war, that was narrated by Morgan Freeman. And at the time, 10 years ago, a lot of people were saying Morgan Freeman doing a film about, you know, the Holocaust survivors. It seemed like a strange choice, but it worked really well.
He's God anyway, so.
Oh, yeah. But then he wasn't. No. You know, he'd done Driving Miss Daisy and a couple of other things.
Right.
But again, it was one of these situations where I had seen, you know, a couple of films that he narrated, and he had a great narrator's voice.
Yes, or maybe this is why he became God, because he did your movie, and it kind of was another step. Maybe Nicole will be promoted as well. I must say, I think initially I was like, well, why isn't a sort of Australian, ginger-haired, very pale-faced woman narrating this? But actually, I think she does do a wonderful job in it.
I think it works, especially against his voice. It works really well. And she, what happened was she saw this little film that we did and was very moved by it and got into a conversation with the rabbi about our other films and basically said she'd be honored to donate her time and talent to this project if it fit into her schedule. So
she didn't charge? She didn't charge a fee?
No, not a cent.
Amazing. Amazing. Yeah. I'll go and buy the hours again on DVD and give her some of that, because she does do a tremendous job.
She was really unbelievable. She gave us 3 days out of a very busy schedule. There hasn't been one person that's narrated a film of ours that has charged us, because we're really not in a position to pay their fees.
Excellent. Let's move away from Nicole, because the film is obviously not about her. It is about Simon Wiesenthal, and a tremendously moving experience. I found it myself. I'd grown up in the 70s here in the UK, and it was something that I didn't really know about. I knew that the boys were from Brazil, and I read that, and we were all told about this guy, but the indefatigable work that Simon Wiesenthal was doing and the independent work that he was doing never really came across until I saw your film. He was an extraordinary, obviously he was an extraordinary man, but it was an extraordinary kind of energy that powered him in a way.
Yeah, it was this focus that he had, because you know, the title of the film, I Have Never Forgotten You, really was the way he lived his life. He wanted to be able, when the day came, to be able to tell those who didn't survive that he didn't forget them, that he did work on their behalf. And, you see in the film, you know, how modestly he lived, and how it affected his family, because it wasn't easy for them to live with somebody who was so completely focused on one thing. He had an amazing photographic memory, too, because you have to remember he was doing all this work at a time when there weren't computers. It was all, you know, in his head or written down on little notepads, and he was working pretty much on his own with the secretary.
So these must have been quite emotional journeys for you, Richard, as well, with your crew going back to these kind of almost, they're almost mythical now. They've passed into the hands. You know, I think your film begins by saying he says I was born in Buzac, which was Austria then, and then it was Ukraine, and then it was Poland, and then it was Russia, and then it's Poland again. These kind of mythical places that for diasporic Jews are so important, really, because they're kind of where it all began, and you kind of went back and found these places.
And and basically what's there now are remnants, graveyards, and if a synagogue still stands, it's not in the best shape. You know, and it is difficult to, you know, you're going to a lot of camps too, and that's always hard.
I just have to see a shot of a former concentration camp, and I'm kind of gone. You know, I'm in tears already. I mean, it must. What's it like for you personally? I don't know your relationship at all. I assume you're Jewish.
Mm-hmm.
Did you feel those ghosts as you were stepping through those gates all the time?
Yeah, it is very difficult. I've been doing this kind of filmmaking for many years, and you know, no matter how many times you go to a camp, it's still very difficult. It's still really, you know, it's hard to sleep for days afterwards. And this particular shoot was not an easy one for us because we did a week, one of the weeks in Poland. It is exactly a year ago. And in the course of 2 days, we were at Sobibor, Treblinka, Majdanek. We must have done about 5 or 6 camps in a 2-day period. It was very, very hard on everybody.
But your film questions the need of his work, whether it's right to avenge war crimes, whether we're right to pursue so many years later this aspect of our history. And I thought that was a very kind of important thing that your documentary did. It didn't just say yes, he was brilliant because he kind of brought Eichmann to justice. It was whether we should or we shouldn't bring Eichmann to justice. How are your feelings on that, having got so close to that as an issue?
Well, it was looking at his work and analyzing whether or not what he was doing was revenge or, as he thought, justice. One of his best-known books was called Justice, Not Revenge. You know, we come to the conclusion that, you know, what he did was create, through this work, a historical record so that, you know, hopefully, down the road, future crimes like this wouldn't happen. Sadly, they have. And that's why in his later years he was speaking out against war crimes in places like the former Yugoslavia and Rwanda. But because of his example, that's why there's a war crimes tribunal in The Hague.
I found one of the other interesting aspects is how much of a one-man band he was. I mean, I always thought the Nazi RG must have had a team of officers or people kind of helping him. He was just like this one guy who wouldn't let it lie in the face of many, many closed doors and drawers.
Until the 60s, he didn't even have a secretary. It was really just him. And then he got a little bit more money so he could afford a part-time secretary. By the 90s, his secretary had become full-time, and there was another part-time person working in the office and a couple of volunteers, but it was never a large organization. You know, the offices were unbelievably modest. It was, you know, 3 rooms.
Richard, if I may just draw things to a close with a wonderful coda, which I think is a great kind of ending to your documentary. It's Simon Wiesenthal's 90th birthday, which he's still in Vienna. He had it, his birthday in Vienna. Tell me a little bit about that 90th birthday party.
Well, Rabbi Heyer called Simon and asked him what would he like to do for his 90th birthday. The group of friends wanted to do something for him. And he said, you know what, I'd like to do a party, and I want to do it at the Imperial Hotel. And the rabbi said, why at the Imperial Hotel? And he said, because that was Hitler's favorite hotel. And whenever Hitler was in Vienna, this is where he stayed. This is where he envisioned running the war at some point. And he said, I want history. I want it to go down in the historical record that Simon Wiesenthal held his 90th birthday with a kosher dinner at the Imperial Hotel. And it was, you know, his way of showing that we're still here, we're still, you know, living life, and Hitler's gone, and we're the ones that survived.
Richard Trank there, the director of I Have Never Forgotten You. Now, as you'll probably know, the Simpsons movie is out. Is it any good, though? Well, it's as good as a TV episode, I would say, which is to say, pretty good. But it's also nothing special to look at, and not half as funny or anarchic as I would have liked it to be. The South Park movie was bigger, longer, and uncut, and I'd have liked to have seen The Simpsons thus, although I suppose the already infamous shot of Bart's willy just about fits those criteria.
Are you aware that a leaky faucet can waste over
2,000 gallons a year?
And turning off your lights can save
enough energy to power Pittsburgh.
And if we just kept our thermostats at 68 in the winter,
we'd be free from our dependency on foreign oil in 17 years.
I'm Colin.
I haven't seen you at school.
Just moved from Ireland. My dad's a musician.
Is he?
He's not Bono.
I just thought because you're Irish and you care about...
He's not Bono.
Do you play?
Just piano, guitar, trumpet, drums and bass.
He's pure gold. For once in your life, be cool.
So, is your name as pretty as your face?
Oh.
You okay there?
Our final American film this week verges on art installation and experimenta. Running Stumbled is a terrifyingly personal documentary by director Jonathan Maringuan about his drug-addled father and suicidal stepmother who live in a squalid house in New Orleans. I met up with John in London this week and asked him how he stood by and filmed while his family combusted around him.
There's a lot of this movie that is about trying to get at these kind of subtle energies, and that's why it was interesting, is that you have a situation that is so animated by dimensional forces. You know, that's the thing. I mean, you've seen the film. It's not just about what's there. It's not just about two people. It's about a house and about the energy of a house. And how do you film that? How do you get at that? And what is that?
Well, just on a practical level, I did wonder how long you stayed there. Where did you sleep there? Did you stay in your dad's house? Where did you sleep when you were filming?
I was there for 10 days, and I slept at a hotel nearby. I did not sleep in the house.
Right, because there's that, whilst you mentioned the kind of new techniques of, I don't know, self-recording diary,
right,
something, whatever this new technique of a film storytelling is, you still face the kind of age-old documentarian question, is that you were in a war zone or you were witnessing a horror, yet you didn't take part. And I kept saying to myself, John, this is your dad, this is your stepmom. Don't you want to settle some of these arguments? Don't you want to take some of those pills away from them? How did you sit there, keep your camera posed, and just let that horror happen?
You know, the thing is, when you talk about how a film was made or why you did something, the truth is so complicated. I mean, there's not really one good damn answer. I mean, honestly, you know, I could sit here and I could give, you know, I give 10 reasons.
Mm-hmm. No, I'm not your therapist.
I make that point because it's interesting, because you basically have, when you say, well, why did you detach from the situation? Well, you know, to make a film about them, you have to detach, because you have to step aside as this train wreck, you know, just, you know, washes by you, and these people that are, you know, maybe abusing you or maybe trying to manipulate you. You do have to, you know, go to a more subtle place, and, you know, you sort of fade away.
Mm-hmm.
Be trying to manipulate you, or, you know, doing all these things.
Mm-hmm.
That's true, and that's a choice. But there's also a non-choice, which is some form of depersonalization. That's a disorder. I mean, there's some sort of like disorder that was also in effect.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that does have to do with, you know, my childhood and who I was and all the shit that happened to me and things that were resonant from this house that I was in. So there's a choice, and there's also forces that are, you know, manipulating you. So.
Because it occurred to me that one might accuse you of being slightly cowardly in that you've taken part just by a camera, and then later you're editing, and presumably you took a long while to edit this and sculpt this into a kind of 14, 15 chapter movie that it is, so that there is some kind of narrative. You've sculpted a narrative out of the mess of this, that you've recorded.
Well, that was the hardest part, was to subvert my need to put my own... I mean, it would have been very easy to put some context, you know, to insert, you know, like, how I felt about, you know, these cats, how I felt about myself and my story. I was not interested in it. It wasn't compelling to me. I wanted to see these two people, and I wanted to see what played out between them. And I knew that I could do it, and I thought that it would be interesting. It's an interesting element that you see me in the beginning. You know that it's me. You see me reacting to the situation, and then you are allowed to travel into my perspective, and then you see what happens when I remain in this place that I should not be in, you know, against all human instincts, remain in a place to experience this.
Mm-hmm. And I think someone can be there. I mean, I don't, but you were so personally involved. If that was my parents, I would have sort of said, "No, come on, guys, you know, calm down." But keep it attacking each other all the time. But I guess that's the compelling drama of the piece and your choice.
Yeah, like,
but I did wonder what your feelings now in that edit, having now sat in front of all that, have your feelings toward your father or fathers in general and fatherhood changed?
Well, I think that after I'd seen him about 1,000 times on the screen, I realized that he actually was my father and not some subtle demonic force that, you know, blew out of a vortex and was just trying to spook me on Halloween. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was actually a real person. I didn't realize that, you know, you talk about, you know, detachment and compartmentalization and memory and all these things. I didn't realize that I really didn't grasp that I was from that place until almost a year into editing.
Do you think you egged on the relationship that by your very presence there made them perform, made them act up?
I think that no, I don't think so. I mean, I think they were already there. Yeah, they were already there.
John, very nice to have met you. I would come around your house, but I'm a bit worried that, you know, there might be a bit of mess, and I presume you don't live in the same sort of situation. an extraordinary piece of work, Running Stumbled, and it's on at the ICA.
So there you have it, the gamut of American film on screens in the UK this week. That's sadly all we've got time for, though. I've been Jason Solomons. Film Weekly is produced by Paul Noble, and until next time, we wish you all happy viewing.